Welcome back to the Paracast, the gold standard of paranormal radio. And now, here's Gene Steinberg.
Gene Steinberg, Chris O'Brien, Chris Lambright, Ray Stanford. The book is Extrascending. We're talking about this film, and you're going into the reaction. But I want to focus very, very shortly here, because it's not a very long amount of time before we want to get into another subject and also answer some of the questions from our listeners. And that is, specifically, what is the development that we're talking about in layman's terms that has revolutionized air travel, space travel, whatever?
Okay, are you asking me or Chris?
Whoever wants to take it.
Okay, I did a little work on this, so let me just, this is the point. The concept that we're talking about here is what is referred to as the directed energy air spike. It's the use of energy alone to create this low-density corridor, this pressure wave, if you want to call it, out in front of your vehicle. The benefit, of course, on the first hand, is that you lower drag to virtually nothing if you do this correctly, because you're creating basically a vacuum corridor or a bubble around yourself where the atmosphere moves away ahead of you. And because of some of the abilities to use the magnetohydrodynamic flow as well as the usage of, you can actually increase thrust somewhat because you enclose the bubble, I think within a half a diameter or something to that effect, behind your vehicle. And in Mirabeau's 1994, I think it was mentioned in Aviation Week in Space Technology, he discusses some of this, that you can actually cause the thing to collapse behind you and increase propulsion out of it. But the initial benefits, especially if you look at the work that's been done afterwards, with the ability to project energy at a point out in front and therefore either mitigate the shockwave or in many cases use that as for direction movement. By increasing pressure on one side or the other, you can actually control the direction. There's a lot of other benefits that are coming out if you look at the research that goes back and references Mirabeau and Reiser's initial paper. Mirabeau himself, and I want everyone to understand, this is a brilliant guy, and I have nothing but great things to say about the fact that he took the time to go see. He took the time to go see what Ray had, and that made a lot of difference. But he's brilliant in his own ideas for the beamed energy propulsion, whether with laser, microwaves, and all that type of thing. And so he knew and had a head start, of course, on the fact that he was interested in this area of aerospace propulsion. But it's the directed energy air spike that you'll suddenly see if you look at the experiment that he did and all of the subsequent illustrations of the concepts that he came up with after, let's say, the 1993 timeframe, certainly after he saw Ray's film, suddenly changed to a lenticular, elliptical dish-shaped vehicle. The only way that we can create the spike or had knowledge of how to create the spike at the time is to either get energy beamed from, say, space-based stations or elsewhere and reflect it to a point, because the idea is, especially if you look at some of the papers that have been written and by NASA and so on, that how to create that amount of energy and get it into a vehicle at this point and be able to fly, that's still a problem, as they say, a technology stretch way ahead, which I think says a substantial amount about the fact that Ray filmed a procession of these things back in 1985.
But how do we make the correlation between that film and subsequent developments other than they being separate issues?
What subsequent developments?
Okay, the advancements in aerospace technology and the film that Ray took.
Basically, Lake Mirabeau was on a particular research track.
Okay, so we're assuming because this guy was brought into the loop about this particular sighting and the film, and thus what happened after that has to be tied to him?
Exactly. In other words, it's too coincidental that all of a sudden he totally switched his approach to something that resembles the analytical work that Ray did on this film that Mirabeau was privy to now.
But is Mirabeau even crediting Ray Stanford about this or not?
Exactly. No, Ray has not been credited.
I didn't expect him to or ask him to. Chris decided to out him on this, that he got this idea from me, but I've never had any intention of doing that. I still have mixed feelings about it. But let me say something here that otherwise we're going to miss it. There are people already that, having seen Chris's book, said, oh, how do we know these were not, that this is not a videotape he's presented of a black project craft or an experiment on a computer or something showing a simulation? Well, I also have film of this beam ahead going on from, let's see, that would be December 4th, 1980, flying back from Mexico City, taken from the air at climbing through 12,000 feet, in which an object approaches a mothership from the north, has the beam ahead, pulsing ahead of it the whole time, goes past the mothership between us and it, and over to a group of huge triangular objects that were on the left. So I have that beam documented way back then, and by no one's stretch of the imagination was there even the possibility of any kind of even a crude method of using a beam ahead at that period. So there was precedent to this. It's just that the film from Corpus Christi is much better. It was the beam down in Mexico. We were between two layers of clouds, and it was creating iron vapor. But this beam is beautifully clear and electrical in the Corpus Christi films. So I wanted to bring that out. And let me mention that in case anybody doubts this, I have a book that Professor Marable gave me. It's about an inch thick. And it's done for the U.S. Space Command or something like that about this magnetohydrodynamic aerodyne that he wanted to fly up there and decided to use the beam ahead, as we call it, as an adjunct after he talked to me. He also asked me, he said, you know, you have given us a quantum leap through the atmosphere into space with this ray. But he said, you know, I think you might be able to help us with another problem. So this thing's magnetohydrodynamically propelled, and we're concerned. We open these landing gear out in this flow, you get chaos, and it could result in, you know, the destruction of the craft, death of those aboard, or anything like that. He said, how in the world do whoever made these things, land these things on landing gear safely? And I said, well, it's very simple, actually. You have a magnetic torus around the object, but it has a magnetic vent at the top and the bottom. You don't use the old engineering standard of putting them out safely on the far edge for maximum stability. You can't do it because it interflows with the flow of plasma in that torus. You open them inside the magnetic vent where it's relatively still. Well, the aerospace engineer that had invited him to come down here with my permission told me that when they got back up to Rensselaer at about 2:15 in the morning, Professor Marable dashed upstairs, drew the modified landing gear plan, and transmitted it to Wright-Patterson. Subsequently, Professor Marable, I very much appreciate, sent me this in-stick book, as I said, with the modified landing gear plan in it. I knew this from theoretical basis, that it had to be there, and I also had showed him a drawing of a landing, a multi-witness landing with an occupant outside the craft that showed where the landing gear were, and they would have been in the magnetic vent. And I said, you got to do it their way or you're in for trouble. He said, that's what I was afraid of. Yeah, we're going to have to move those into the cone of relative stillness. And so I...
So Ray, you're okay with this. You're okay with that.
Oh, I'm okay with it. I'm okay, real okay.
You're fine that you've helped move aerospace propulsion and the theoretical side of this whole thing in
that's
a divine
right.
fashion.
And I harbor no resentments. People say, oh, don't you think he's making a lot off patents on this? I said, look, I don't care. I didn't do this for money. I wanted to help humankind get into space. I believe that, as some of the astronauts will tell you, they had an epiphany when they were flying out there and looking at space beyond the atmosphere and looking down at the Earth. I think that the more we of this planet see infinity, the more we realize, in effect, how small we are, and we begin to take hopefully, a more benign cosmological view of humankind and, in fact, of the universe at large. That was my intent from the time I was a kid, and I only felt I was helping fulfill this in giving this to Professor Marable. Glad I did, and I'm not interested in making a red cent off of it.
So you're a team player. You're a team player. You're not into this subject for fame and glory. You're into it to help further our knowledge. And
right, yeah. If I wanted fame and glory, I would have published this a long time ago, you know, and tried to sell books and videotapes and so on and so forth. I'm not interested, really.
It'd be nice, though, of course, if the government was more forthcoming about space travel, the fact that our space program has languished for so many years, so you can have all the developments in the world, but if they're not going to put money into increasing the frequency of space travel, moving to more advanced technologies, you have to wonder where it all goes. We have a lot more to discuss. We have Ray Stanford. We have Chris Lambright. The book is called X Descending, and we're focusing on how aerospace technology was impacted by the film of UFOs taken by Ray Stanford. You're with Gene Steinberg and Chris O'Brien. You're in
the Paracast.
So here's what happened. I was placing an order online. The site went down. It just stopped responding. It took hours before it returned, but I'd already placed the order with another company. If your site goes down, you could lose business. And if you have a business or personal site, you'll want to know it's easy to run and it will stay online. At iWeb, your site is hosted on one of the most reliable networks in the world. Check it out. iWeb.com. That's iWeb.com.
You expect professional service from your doctor, your accountant, and even the girl who takes your morning coffee order. Why not from your domain registrar, too? Namecheap.com provides stellar service with no sneaky upselling. We offer more features and security options for your website than there are ways to order a latte. And new domains come with WhoisGuard to protect your personal info. At Namecheap.com, you can get your domain for as low as $2.99. Now is a great time to get to know Namecheap.com.
Digestive health is the key to wellness and elimination of toxins. That bears repeating. Digestive health is the key to wellness and elimination of toxins. And Pro-EM-1 Daily Probiotic Cleanse is the key to digestive health. Pro-EM-1 is a powerful liquid probiotic, strong enough to cleanse, gentle enough to use every day. Pro-EM-1 is dairy, wheat, and soy free. Contains all natural and certified organic ingredients. Contains no preservatives or animal products. Supports a healthy digestive and immune system. Supports weight loss. Improves absorption of food nutrients, aids in controlling yeast infections, is never freeze-dried, and uses three groups of live, viable, beneficial microbes to cleanse and remove toxins. Order Pro-EM-1 Daily Probiotic Cleanse at Terraganics.com, spelled TerraganiX.com, Terraganics.com, or call toll-free 866-369-3678. That's 866-369-3678. Pro-EM-1, the raw probiotic. Healthy soils grow healthy plants. So before you plant your survival garden this year, is your soil healthy? Maximize your crisis garden soil with EM1 from Terraganics. EM1 Organic Soil Conditioner, Fertilizer Amendment, and Compost Accelerant provides healthier gardens and faster, efficient garden composting. EM1 from Terraganics.com quickly improves soil structure by increasing nutrient availability and converting organic matter into soil humus. This improves seed germination and root growth, improves plant quality, size, color, flavor, nutrient value of fruits and vegetables, and improves shelf life. And when rain is not in the forecast, no worries. EM1 improves moisture retention in soils, helping reduce drought stress. Just like you prepare all else, prepare your crisis garden for maximum yields with EM1 from Terraganics.com. Order now at TerraganiX.com or call toll-free 866-369-3678. That's 866-369-3678. Terraganics. Life's getting better.
Hi, I'm Mark Craighead, founder of Crossbreed Holsters. I designed our top-selling holster, the Super Tuck Deluxe, to solve the problems of being poked, pinched, and gouged while carrying concealed. The Super Tuck Deluxe is the most comfortable, most concealable holster on the market today. We offer a 2-week free trial and a lifetime warranty.
Visit us at crossbreedholsters.com. Don't forget, crossbreedholsters.com.
In a coming-apart world, you need something to keep it tied together. That something is Atwood Rope, the highest quality rope made in the USA from exotic braids for military, rescue, arborists, shipyards, towline, or boating. Quality rope at affordable prices you and your customers can depend on. Find a dealer or shop online at atwoodrope.net. Enter promo code RADIO to receive 100 feet of 550 paracord free with purchase. Atwood Rope, working to keep the world tied together.
We'd like to hear from you. If you have a comment or question about the Paracast, send it to news@theparacast.com. That's news@theparacast.com. And if you'd like to catch up on past episodes, we have hundreds of shows for you to download direct from theparacast.com. That's theparacast.com. Or check us out at iTunes.
We continue with Gene Steinberg, Chris O'Brien, a second Chris, Lambright, Ray Stanford. The book is X Descending. Chris, you want to pick up on the questioning?
I do have one question here that relates to the first part of the show that we're talking about. And someone just pointed out that, you know, the term aerospace, let me get it here, aerospace propulsion is a little bit, as son of a skunk, one of our forum posters puts it, The term aerospace propulsion, and more especially the word aerospace, is a very broad brush. Are we talking aircraft propulsion, spacecraft propulsion, or all of the above? Now, I think what we've been talking about is analogous to the prow of a boat cutting waves to create less friction so a boat can go forward in water. If you apply that particular concept of the air spike in the atmosphere, it's almost like you're creating a prow of a boat in the atmosphere that negates sonic booms and allows the craft to move through the atmosphere with little or no friction. I just wanted to kind of underscore that. So how would you describe Leek Marabou's gestalt and realizing all of a sudden, boom, I have this new way of looking at this? What are we talking about here? How would you encapsulate this field of study, you know, in a term?
Okay, you're asking me, Ray Stanford?
Yeah, sure, Ray.
Okay,
and Chris.
Okay, yeah. All right. Let me make something clear. I think some of the listeners may not understand. This is not a matter of just not creating a shockwave. It is a matter of saving not only a lot of original wear and tear on the spacecraft, but it is, more importantly, it is a matter that if you don't have this type of device, you are creating and pushing a hypersonic shockwave occurs when the atoms, the molecules of the atmosphere do not tend to move out of the way. They become compressed. And what you're doing, if you don't have this, you are pushing thousands of tons of atmosphere. That's why it was so hard for humankind to even break the sound barrier originally, because you are pushing a solid, basically almost solid wall of atmosphere, the thing that hits you as a sonic boom on the ground. You're pushing that. With this, you're not only not pushing it, the important thing is you're not creating it. You are electrifying it ahead of you, expanding it to the sides around a relatively evacuated column and moving it around you and closing it properly in a spiraler fashion where you create a proper condition that, in other words, you're creating pressure behind the craft, which actually helps push it forward while having virtually no resistance in front. And you're saving a vast amount of money and fuel wherever the fuel is coming from, the ground or within the craft, because it will go, at least according to even the early phase of this research at Rensselaer, 10 times more efficiently with a tenth of the energy that would be required if it were pushing the shockwave. So this is obviously what Marabou had in mind. This is what I am happy and proud to say that I gave him the idea for. And someone wrote, the author Chris Lambright, the other day, someone sent an indirect communication to him, a guy saying, well, you know, how can he claim that he helped anybody make an invention? The Polaris missile had a physical spike in front of it at a certain stage, so we already had the idea that the physical spike is. My comment on that was that Flash Gordon, back in the 40s and 50s in the comic strips, had a physical spike out in front of his spacecraft. A kid would know that that's supposed to help it get through the atmosphere with more efficiency. But there's a big difference in saying that man knew how to create a physical spike and stick it out in front of a craft than saying he knew how to electrify the atmosphere for 30 diameters out in front of him and move it out of the way to where there's virtually no resistance whatsoever. And it also keeps down not only cost, but ablative heat off the craft. So this is what Marabou very justifiably had in mind, and the secret of which I feel for sure he learned from what I showed him, because he thanked me three times for giving him this information.
Well, let's hope that something like this somehow influences the future progression of the space program beyond where we are now. Do you have any optimism at all, Ray, about a renewal of space travel, of attempts at space travel? It seems that the space program has gone the wrong direction.
Well, you're right, and I'm glad you brought that up, because there have been all these, in my opinion, myths about we have duplicated alien technology. I'm sorry, but, you know, just a few months ago, my wife and I heard one of these Black Project craft fly over here so high we couldn't spot it, but it was making so much noise that we thought it was going to break the windows out of our big old house here. And they are not using ET technology. And the thing is, even about this thing that I showed Professor Marabou and have showed many others, it's still a matter of our learning how to generate it efficiently in front, efficiently in front of the craft. We know the secret, and it's been tested in a very primitive way with great efficiency in the hypersonic wind tunnel at Rensselaer. But it's still a matter of actually making this thing, having the energy source inside a vehicle to produce a good beam ahead. So the gift is there. It's just a matter now of making it practical. But regarding renewing the space program, it's obvious we don't have other types of propulsive adjuncts very much, or we wouldn't be using still this old reaction propulsion that we do see in Black Project craft. And I have photographed some of these things in broad daylight, some of these Black Project craft, knew what they were at the time. But what I'm hoping is that hopefully in my lifetime, I don't know if I have many years left, but there will be a turn toward looking more and more at, for example, as Chris Lambright said, I have a lot of stuff in these films that is in many ways a lot more amazing, exciting, and potentially useful to science. That's what I want to do with this. I don't want to, you know, try to publish another UFO book necessarily. I want it to be milked scientifically, analyzed in a way that we can invigorate a space program. Otherwise, it looks like our space program is pretty well stuck in the 1950s and 60s reaction propulsion mud.
Let me make a couple of observations, if I can, regarding the technological aspects of this. You'll see that I mentioned a patent that was filed and given to Kevin Kremeyer, who's another engineer, and I believe he's from Arizona, and in which he describes this filamenting laser. It's an actually, it almost sounds identical to kind of what we're discussing here, but the idea of being able to put energy along a narrow beam out in front and creating this low-density corridor that as it collapses behind you, it adds thrust. The reason I mention that is because not only is there another person after the fact, after Mirabeau, who's patented something which they clearly knew to be new and had not been put into use or actually was not even functional just yet. And I exchanged some emails with him, and I said I was really interested in it because I think I had seen something similar to this. I was referring to Ray's film, you know, in a film that was taken several years earlier. And, of course, his comment was, boy, it's kind of depressing to think that here he filed a patent for something that now he hears was already, you know, in production. But that's simply another little factor, I think, that suggests that what Ray filmed was not something that was based on technology that was already at least to the point of where we were in production and producing it and flying it around. The other point I want to make was, if you listen to what Ray described about initially taking the film, the last of these objects, the one that I've discussed in my book, slowed down and waited for the final object to catch up to it before it moved.
Or at least they're being polite to each other.
I'm not making the point.
I understand the point. We're talking to Chris Lambright. We're talking to Ray Stanford with Gene Steinberg and Chris O'Brien. You're in
the Paracast.
America's number one source for independent talk radio for over a decade. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Ray Perkins, a reclusive veteran burned out from the Gulf War, lives tortured by relentless, perplexing nightmares. Nightmares of a horrific battle in deep space and of a mysterious woman suffering in agony for her devastated world. A woman not yet born, calling across centuries to him. Then, a coincidence leads him to his destiny, his chance to alter the universe. Attack! Attack! Of the Rockaways. The former fiction editor for Star Wars and Indiana Jones, Robert Simpson, writes, "The soul of the novel Attack of the Rockaways lies in its heart and passion for building a convincing tale of a love that spans a galaxy. A thrilling story. Attack of the Rockaways is available now. Read a sample chapter and get a special discount off of the cover price at our website, rockoids.com. That's rockoids.com. Attack of the Rockaways, a novel in the grand science fiction tradition."
We all know that Berkey water purification systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey guy offers amazing specials for Berkey water filtration systems. The Berkey light systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey light system today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey light, the Berkey guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
That's what it sounds like when a burglar kicks in the door of a dark house that looks like no one is home. Don't let your home be the next target. Make it look like someone is home watching television with Fake TV. Fake TV is a small electronic device that makes the same light as a real television, so from outside it looks like someone is home watching TV. Fake TV plugs in just like a lamp on a timer, but is far more convincing to burglars. Fake TV deters burglars, costs far less than an alarm, and is highly recommended by numerous police departments. Use it anytime you're away from home. To order your Fake TV for only $34.95, go to faketv.com. Or call 1-877-5-FAKE-TV. Each additional Fake TV is only $29.95. So get one for you and one for a loved one for safety, security, and peace of mind for both of you. Call 877-5-FAKE-TV or go to faketv.com. FakeTV.com, the burglar deterrent.
We all know the importance of having storable foods. But what about when the food runs out? What then? For real food independence, you need a supply of non-hybrid seeds. Introducing the Survival Seed Vault from MyPatriotSupply.com. The Survival Seed Vault is sealed for freshness and includes 20 varieties of easy-to-grow non-hybrid seeds for only $37.95. For less than $40, you've got real food independence, and the Survival Seed Vault includes detailed planting and seed-saving instructions. Imagine the barter power you'll have when the food supply does collapse. Right now, save $9 instantly when you buy three or more Survival Seed Vaults from MyPatriotSupply.com. Same-day shipping on all orders, plus free shipping on orders over $49. Call 866-229-0927. That's 866-229-0927. Or discover more emergency preparedness products at MyPatriotSupply.com. That's MyPatriotSupply.com.
I hope that you do listen to the Paracast because you will learn a great deal about the paranormal.
We have Chris Lambright, we have Chris O'Brien, we have Ray Stanford and Gene Steinberg. You're in the Paracast. The book is known as X Descending, and in part discovers and talks about the UFOs photographed by Ray Stanford, how they were used apparently in advancing aerospace technology. So just to kind of summarize before we go into some more topics, Chris Lambright, where do we take it from here? Where is space travel gone since this with the improvement of this development?
Well, if nothing else, I think it's notable that to this point, even though there's a lot of research being done in Japan and other places and ideas for the use of this kind of depositing energy in ahead of a moving body, that we don't yet see anything like what Ray had on film. We don't see any, even Mirabeau's, having gone back a few years ago to do some work at the Air Force, I guess it was out at the White Sand, on his light craft, was still using the model that he initially had intended for shining lasers beneath it. Nobody to this date has demonstrated a practical use of an energy beam out in front to do the types of things that Ray is just, you know, had on film.
Yeah, that we know of.
Yeah, well, there you go, that we know of. Now, of course, Professor Mirabeau has his Light Craft Technologies International Corporation that he set up, and I hope he does very well with it. But my aim is to get the information out there. I mean, I believe I waited a substantially long time saying nothing, and I'm with Ray. You know, I'm not totally comfortable with the idea of thinking that I'm outing somebody. I did a lot of soul searching on whether I should say anything about it, but in the long run, I think Ray's film and the Benowitz film are evidence that there is something else going on here that needs to be addressed. And clearly, in the case of Ray's film, there's a technology here that, at least, like maybe like you were saying, we're not being told about. So where the technology originates, I hope we'll find out. But the point is, I think...
Can I add something to Chris's...
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. I want to commend Chris because he has done a prodigious job in ferreting out the research that seems to have occurred, that did in fact occur after Mirabeau's visit here, and relating it to what may have happened as a result of Mirabeau's visit. He went into detail. He worked overtime on the internet and anywhere he could get information. I don't think anything has been as thoroughly investigated in UFOs hardly as Chris did in trying to check into the background and to see whether this kind of device existed before I filmed these things. And I think it's to his credit that he did not take something on faith, but went and really did very hard work, his homework, on this particular issue, which is a big and important issue. And I want to conclude this statement by saying that the principle has been shown at Rensselaer and in other places that Chris mentions in his book. Now, the principle that we could in theory do this, there's a big difference in showing on a small scale in the laboratory, in a hypersonic tunnel locally with terrestrial easy-to-access power supplies, that the principle works. The big difference here is getting the energy level to or inside of a craft to where this can be done at a practical level in our atmosphere on a larger scale. Let's distinguish the two. The theory has been established now in the lab at Rensselaer and others, as Chris describes for you in the book, but the practicality of having the energy, that's the big thing, is getting the energy to either by beam or inside the craft and projecting it. That's the part that seems to have been the problem. So let's distinguish the two things. The principle is sound. It's a matter of applying it at our present level of energy sources.
The question from one of our listeners, and basically I'm going to paraphrase the question. This comes from Century, who's been a poster here for just over a year. There's been a recent discussion on the Paracast forum of Kelly Johnson's UFO sightings, but whether or not any advances in Lockheed can be traced to them is unproven. I'll put this out to you, Ray and Chris. Chris has done an incredible amount of research into this whole subject, and I really commend you. I'm really awed at the amount of time that it must have taken to dig in and drill down on some of these, very esoteric subject matter and coming up with the amount of documentation that you did. Really, my hat's off to you. And what do you guys think? Have we seen any advances spurred on by the study of UFOs? I mean, this is one example. Do you think there are any others that are part of the public domain already?
That's a tough question, because I am firmly convinced that if you really want to keep something secret, you can certainly do so. And if I was going to put some technology into something that I'm building, I would make sure that on the outside, at least, it looked like something you would believe I could build. So whether the technology is inside of something that looks like a conventional aircraft design, that's the rub. You're not going to know.
The B-2 having the B-2 bomber having an anti-gravity takeoff assist.
Exactly. I mean, you hear that, but you have no truck with it, because what can you do? I mean, unless somebody gave you documentation and you knew someone to speak to, which, in my opinion, that's kind of one of the reasons that I wanted to use these two films. There are people alive today, and there are their names. Go talk to them. There are people that could be called to account not only for what happened to Paul Benowitz, but people who clearly know a lot to be said about what Ray has on film, people he's not named yet, and he's mentioned some things that are coming up that I've not, I'd leave to him to say. But as far as technology, well, let me put it this way. If with my limited resources, I can at least find what I found enough to compel me to believe there is this out there. Whoever owns the technology, who knows? I think there was one reference. It was either to Ben Rich or maybe Kelly Johnson, that some of these are we made, some of them they made, whoever they would be. But the point is, if with my limited resources, I can go this far and look at what Ray's able to do with camera and a good eye and be on top of it.
And a good analytical mind, too, I might add.
Well, now, obviously, Chris, if you listen to him, you can tell. But Chris, with the money, other people must have far more. If I was the Air Force or the government or somebody, who can say what they've got?
Okay, well, you brought up Paul Benowitz, and we need to dovetail into that whole part of your book, which is just like the portion about Ray's work in Lake Maribou. This is really fascinating material as well. What? Give us a little quick thumbnail sketch of some background information of how you got involved in the Benowitz case and why this particular film and series of photographs compelled you to really dig deep and really uncover some very, very, I think, very important information about the Benowitz case.
Well, clearly I've been interested in this subject for a long, long, long time. Back in the early 80s, in particular, here in Texas, of course, I knew Tommy Bland very well. He knows just about everybody, and he and I had worked very closely together because we lived close together. And at one point, he mentioned having heard that some scientist out in New Mexico was either picking up some kind of unusual signals or had seen some unusual things. And of course, I realized, and then within the next year or so, that he had heard through wherever his grapevine was, that this was Paul Benowitz. And of course, like everybody else, or like many of us didn't really even get into this, let alone be aware of it, until probably 83, sometime, you know, after the fact, because not much had been said, if I'm not mistaken, outside of the APRO and maybe the little New Mexico, you know, wherever Paul Benowitz's local circuit was, about what was truly going on. But somewhere pretty quickly, as I began to hear more and more, and seeing some of the documents that were now getting released and hearing about who's saying this or that, and Bill Moore and Richard Doty, and what everybody was saying that Paul was saying, you know, and I began to realize, well, and it's one of my own personal mottos, that if all you know is what someone else told you, you don't really know anything. I think Chris O'Brien has a quote.
Oh, boy, amen.
Yeah.
Oh,
so
yeah.
And at that point,
I love stories because then I can drill down on them.
Yeah. And so at that point, I thought, if somebody's calling the Air Force and talking about aliens and who knows, the Air Force is not going to get involved. That's a public relations scam waiting to happen. But if they
That's right, but we'll get into more of this in a moment. Chris Lambright and Ray Stanford with Gene Steinberg. Chris O'Brien, you're in
the Paracast.
Are you tired of searching for great talk radio?
Something more important.
Search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Graphic Converter is the image manipulation tool for the rest of us. It does not use any database. You get full control of all your files. Want to view the images of a folder? Drag it into Graphic Converter, and a powerful browser opens up to show your image files. You could use it for slideshows. You could use it to import images from digital cameras or from scanners. Need to do some image editing? You can do that too in Graphic Converter. Also, print catalogs. Convert from so many formats I can't even list them. Download now to see if Graphic Converter is good for you, like 1.5 million other users. Guess what? You could save money when you buy Graphic Converter. Use the coupon code Night Owl. Use the coupon code Night Owl to get a special price for Graphic Converter. Go to LemkeSoft.com. That's LemkeSoft.com. LemkeSoft.com. LemkeSoft.com.
If you're taking 1, 2, 5 or more nutritional supplements, please stop. Simplify your supplementation with Bio Superfood, the most advanced nutritional whole food supplement you can buy. Men, women, children, even Olympic athletes the world over have discovered Bio Superfood from BioAge.com. And now take just one nutritional supplement instead of many. The Bio Superfood formulas are whole food products composed with 4 of the most nutrient-dense algae found on Earth. Bio Superfood for the brain helps with focus, memory, clarity, and mood. If you can increase brain health, the rest of the body is a no-brainer. Bio Superfood has zero toxicity and is safe for you and your family. Learn more and order your Bio Superfood formulas at BioAge.com, spelled BioAge.com, BioAge.com, or call 877-288-9116. That's 877-288-9116. BioAge, the age of advanced organics.
Don't answer it.
If fear strikes your heart when the phone rings, knowing it may be another bill collector, it's time for you to call Zero Debt in 90 Days. 800-477-9256. Settlements, bankruptcy, and attorneys are not the answer and may end up costing you up to 10 times more than necessary. Listen, if you're already in debt, does it make sense to get buried in another payment plan? Zero Debt in 90 Days gets you out of debt in 90 days guaranteed without a payment plan and without attorneys or going to court. Get the fastest relief from debt on the planet when you call 800-477-9256. If you have debt with the IRS, credit cards, student loans, or a foreclosure, we can help at Zero Debt in 90 Days, and we are the only organization to provide written guarantees on the results. Go to ZeroDebtGuaranteed.com. That's ZeroDebtGuaranteed.com. Or call now for free information. 800-477-9256. That's 800-477-9256.
Crank up your savings at the Webb's headquarters for hand crank and solar power preparedness. 21stCenturyGoods.com. Save now on solar generators from $289. Solar lanterns, just $24.95. Solar waterproof flashlights, only $12.95. Cook Anywhere solar ovens from $279.95. Portable solar panels from 21stCenturyGoods.com give you the freedom to harness the power of the sun to charge your gear wherever you go. Show your patriotism with our line of solar flagpole lights. Plus, find a full line of emergency and shortwave radios, solar lanterns, and LED flashlights. And see our monthly two-for-one specials at 21stCenturyGoods.com. Spelled the number two, the number one, ST, CenturyGoods.com. Or call 866-999-8422. Spend $100 or more and get a free hand crank solar flashlight when you mention you heard us on GCN at checkout. Crank up your savings only at 21stCenturyGoods.com.
This is Jerome Clark, author of the UFO Encyclopedia and other books. You're listening to the Paracast.
With Gene Steinberg and Chris O'Brien, we have Ray Stanford and Chris Lambright. Now, understand that, you know, a lot of these things, it represents jargon to most people. It's something that a lot of people are not familiar with because what happened with Paul Benowitz happened a long time ago. And other galaxies. So maybe backtrack, Chris Lambright, and explain who is Paul Benowitz. Is he even still alive?
No, I believe he passed away back in early, I believe 2003, perhaps somewhere a few years ago.
Right.
Unfortunately, but if you want to go and explain, okay, Paul Benowitz owned a company in Albuquerque, New Mexico, which was virtually across the street from one of the main gates to Kirtland Air Force Base. And they did a lot of testing, built testing equipment, I believe humidity testing or humidity-related equipment, and had a number of contracts with more government agencies than I even realized at the time. And apparently was doing very well, lived in one of the nicest locales in the Albuquerque area, and happened to live at a place that was a stone's throw, so to speak, from the fence line of Kirtland Air Force Base, and perhaps at the closest point, maybe a quarter of a mile from the northernmost foothills of the Manzana Weapons Storage Area. But needless to say, he was a guy, like many of us, who I believe already had some interest in UFO phenomenon. In my understanding, it may have gone back quite a while. But in the late 1970s, particularly 1979, when there were a lot of reports of cattle mutilations and such going on in the northern New Mexico, Colorado area, he apparently also gotten interested in that, and subsequent to some other things that went on, came to know Gabe Valdez, who many of your listeners probably know, was a state trooper over the Hickory Apache Indian Reservation area, and actually right there, kind of where Dulce, the term Dulce comes from, because it's the small town, basically kind of in the foothills there. But so at some point, Paul decided in, I believe, July of 1979 that he'd go visit Gabe, and Gabe would take him on a ride, you know, on his night patrols, I suppose. The next day, and of course, they apparently saw some very unusual things on that ride, and what that was, I don't know. But what basically began interest primarily, I think, in that area is a small Polaroid that Paul took that he later on back in Albuquerque showed to his wife, and she pointed out something, you know, and I reproduced a small version of that in my book, and that got his interest that must be something going on up there. And over the next 6 months, at least twice, I believe, once with one of his sons, he went back and spent some time up there. The only reason I'm focusing on that, even though to this day I do think he described some very unusual things he was seeing, but the point, his interest was in that area, was not in Albuquerque area at that time. When he came back from, I believe, his last trip, that his wife had heard something unusual, and that kind of got him to wonder, even though, of course, we're talking about a very esoteric subject to begin with, so where your logic and reality stretches to, you know, your conclusion. So he decided maybe he should keep an eye out of the area right around his home. And that's what my understanding, and this is based on material he sent me, written, some of it handwritten, a lot of it typed out, you know, legal-sized pages explaining everything that occurred. That's what got him on his roof, and the best I could determine was right around the middle of December of 1979. And at that point, as described in the book, he saw some unusual things going on at the base of the Manzano weapon storage area, and apparently, as he described, got his wife up there at 1.2 to watch these things. And over a period of, I presume, several days, and I don't know if they were consecutive nights or, you know, but I would say within, let's say, maybe a week or so, several days, he got filmed. I believe he had a camera with a telescope on it. He had a Hasselblad still camera that he'd used. He had a 8mm movie camera with a 6-degree lens on it. And he had this all set up on his roof. So and my take on it was he got the goods, and he did it in the way I think I would have done it. And at that point, not knowing what he saw, but from what he had described to me, at some point he decided, you know, he doesn't see the alarms going off. I mean, there's no, you know, the security guards come racing around the bend, and he got concerned, as I believe he really thought he was doing the right thing. He was being a concerned citizen, that just maybe the people at the Air Force or the Manzano security don't even know what's going on. And he picked up the phone and called the base and got in touch with Ernest Edwards and told him he wanted to talk to him about the landings on the mountain. And that, if nothing else, tells you these things were in the vicinity of the mountain for him to call Ernest Edwards, who was responsible for the protecting the security inside the fence line.
Yeah, and Chris, I think you should also, you know, provide a little bit more of a detailed description of Manzano. This is one of the most secure nuclear weapon storage facilities on the planet. I mean, we're not talking just, you know, artillery shells and rounds of ammunition for small caliber weapons. We're talking nuclear weapon storage facility. That's really important for people to understand.
Right. Yes, yes. And I think it's, and in fact, I had clipped articles that were put out by even the penal system, the jail system in New Mexico, talking about how some of their, you know, they looked at the Manzanos as a model for how secure you can actually be. This site had at least, I think, a double perimeter electrified fence, and the same article described sometimes you'd find people who had come wandering across the, you know, got caught on the fence, that sort of thing. But it was extremely secure. And to, just so everyone knows, since I have put pictures in this book, back at the time that we were there, which was clearly in the 80s, there were signs on the fence that said no photographs allowed, no photography allowed. And one time when I was there, an old woman came driving slowly down the road and rolled her window down and looked at me and said, "You're not supposed to be taking pictures." Okay, those signs aren't there now. If you've been in the area, and I took time a year ago and drove out there all the way, spent 2 days and took pictures and films. And anyway, the point is there are no longer any signs on the fence that say no photographs allowed. And I think it's simply because the housing areas are encroaching right to the fence line almost on all the west side. You've got houses now that you can walk right up to the fence. So I think it's a moot point whether there's going to be anything that's not going to be visible from this side, from the west side of the slopes. But in Paul Benowitz's day, not much of that was there. I mean, there was a pretty wide stretch heading down towards the Albuquerque, you know, city area. And from in the valley, you really can't see the foothills of the Manzanos very clearly. And at any distance, if lights went along, anybody could have shrugged their shoulders and said, maybe it's helicopters. So I have a feeling that back in the day, Paul's perch on his rooftop, which is above the second floor, gave him a front row seat with his equipment to be able to see right into this area that anything that was actually sitting down low on the ground at that point probably was not even visible.
So he was putting himself in, long and short of it, in a situation where he may be seeing things he should not have been able to see.
Oh, I think that's absolutely the case. I think in the long run, the evidence shows whoever owned or built or whatever you want to say, whoever was flying what he filmed, that my conviction now is, oh, they were known to be there. They were allowed and were there for reasons of their own. It was Paul who wasn't supposed to be there. And he just stumbled into it innocently or otherwise, for his own, you know, because he was interested in the subject and his wife mentioned something to him, and the drop of the dominoes, he ends up on his roof at a time. And I've mentioned this to other people as well. Based on looking at this, I have to conclude there's no reason to believe that he simply got there on the first night. For all we know, things may have been coming and going from this area for a time, and Paul, when he finally got up there and saw them, he stumbled into the middle of something. What was going on? You know, I've had people point out that, you know, some of the distances between the objects that Paul sighted seem to match, roughly speaking, some of the distances between the bunkers that were there. That's all speculation, of course. I understand that. But
So is there a possible natural explanation for all this, or do we have to think that more than that was going on?
Oh, no. No, just all you have to do is look at those gorgeous color photographs in Chris's book. No way.
Yeah. You know, I want to make also this point. When I first saw or heard about these films, I was simply told, oh, they're just little lights. And I suppose from Paul's description that, of course, he's standing on his roof excited with his camera running, that, you know, a lot of this was jostling around. But he sent me images that were actually stopped on a reel-to-reel, a small little film editor, off of that screen where he could, as I described in the book, I believe he could adjust that prism a little to actually accentuate them. And he told me the true film is much more vivid than just the pictures that he sent. But it wasn't until I actually began to take them into Photoshop and use some other software that allows you to actually really get down into the brightest area that what you see in those pictures was new to me. And I guarantee you somebody will look at those and recognize something about what's going on in them. I mean, I don't have that kind of expertise.
Well, we know Ray has that observational acuity.
I'd like to make comments. I hope the listeners will realize that, except for maybe one of these pictures in Chris's, but they have been published before, and they are remarkable. Not only that, but one sees these objects on the Manzano that, for example, have a line, apparently around a disc-like shape, it would seem, of blue lights. Now, I've become very familiar from my own observations and filmings of high-energy emitters sequencing around the edge of these objects. It looks very much the same to me. Someone might say, well, you talk about them sequencing, and it looks like they're on the whole time. Well,
I'll tell you what, we are, of course, defining what Paul Benowitz had observed and photographed. We have Chris Lambright. The book is called X Descending. We have Ray Stanford with us, with Gene Steinberg, Chris O'Brien. You're in
the Paracast.
The GCN Radio Network, providing the world with hard-hitting talk radio. GCN. Great talk radio starts here.
Hi, Ted Anderson announcing a great way to listen to radio on the telephone. By calling 760-569-7700, you'll be hearing GCNLive.com programs in seconds. Come to GCNLive.com, find your favorite host's dedicated phone number, and hear them 24-7. You heard me right, every show has a dedicated phone number. Stop by GCNLive.com and bookmark their number today. And again, that's 760-569-7700. We the people grow cotton, weave fabric, engrave ink, embed strips and fibers to protect from counterfeit and carting to a private bank, having it lent back at interest, forcing taxes to service debt. This capitalism, or was Jefferson correct when stating a central bank issuing the public currency is a greater menace to the liberties of the people than a standing army? Ted Anderson, I'm placing a free silver dollar in a book that explains our monetary system. Call for your copy, 800-686-2237. It's time to understand the system. Call 800-686-2237. That's 800-686-2237.